The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 607 for Sunday, May 29th, 2016. Folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show that's like car talk for Apple geeks. You send in your questions, your tips, your cool stuff found. We answer your questions, we share your tips, we share your cool stuff found. The goal is for all of us to learn at least three new things each and every time we get together. Three of those things today are going to be our sponsors, including a new one, SeatGeek, at SeatGeek.com, where you can download their app and then use coupon code MGG to save $20 on your first order. I am a longtime SeatGeek user, so I can't wait to tell you more about that. Power Photos from Fat Cat Software, the successor to iPhoto Library Manager. And at FatCatSoftware.com/MGG, you can save 20% on that. I have a story to tell you about that shortly here. And FreshBooks at FreshBooks.com/MGG, where you can get 30 days free of their awesome invoicing and accounting tool built just for you. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
And John, here, or rather there, at PodcastAwards.com. Yes, you folks nominated us, and we are on the ballot for this year. So voting started this morning, mere hours before we started recording this. So now you can go back, and I would love for you to go back to PodcastAwards.com and vote for us. John, you will be happy to note that your preferred path of vote early, vote often, I believe applies here. Everyone can vote once per day. And we've got 14 days, I believe, to do the voting. So please vote. And you can choose other podcasts, too. There's many, many categories. We're in the technology category. So we'd love to have your support there. Vote early, vote often, right, John?
No. Once.
No. Well, once per day. I mean, it's meant to have people vote every day. That's the point. So we want them to vote often. It's okay. It's part of the rules. So that's good. And you can vote too, John. Vote for all your favorites. I encourage you. Hello?
Can I vote for us?
Yeah, that's the idea. Yeah, but don't vote for us now. Do the show with me now. And then maybe later.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, you can vote for us. All right. Let's jump right into this. Chris has a stellar story to tell us. Longtime listener, first time writer. He says, I recently spilled a full cup of coffee over my newish Apple keyboard. This is the new one with the lightning connector and the internal battery. I immediately switched it off, turned it upside down, and dried it with a kitchen roll as best I could, and then let it dry completely overnight and tried it again. It worked, but some of the keys were sticking and the action was key dependent. I persevered for a day or so and then decided it was either a new one or a good rinse. So with nothing to lose, I washed it under a running tap and scrubbed it with a nail brush, getting it thoroughly wet. I dried it and left it in front of an air conditioning unit for 2 days, changing its orientation periodically. I switched it on and I am now typing this message to you on it. It is working perfectly. Your listeners may be interested to know that there is at least a chance that a liquid damaged new keyboard can be brought back to life, even if it is necessary to expose it to additional water to remove the residue of the initial spill. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Chris. As we like to say, you know, when in doubt, apply water, right? No, that's typically bad, but in this case, pretty good. It's interesting seeing how many electronics companies, but Apple in particular, has been sort of quietly protecting the internals of their devices from water damage. I mean, you know, look at the current crop of iPhones, right? The 6S, the 6S Plus, and as I'm to find out, the SE all have an additional layer of sort of water impedance, if you will, to keep the water from advancing into the phone. And you can go online and find tests and stuff, YouTube videos, where people have put these phones in water and you know, like a 5S won't last 3 or 4 minutes submerged in water, but the SE and the 6S will go an hour, which is pretty interesting. It's pretty cool. Yes.
Yeah. Water I'd resistance. Say for yes. a keyboard itself.
Yeah, well, it's pretty good.
The proof is in this testimonial. Yep. I personally, well, you know, I think I probably would have tried something like that.
Well, yeah, he got to the point where it was, and I love it when electronics get to the point of either I fix it or I replace it, because then the world is my oyster. I don't care if I break it because it's already broken. So it's good stuff, man. Hot soapy water. Well, actually not soapy in his case, but you know, hot and watery water. Very, very watery. Make sure it's watery water, John.
Not heavy water, though.
No. Well, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
I'm going to do a nuclear reaction. You may need some of that.
Yeah. 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 That's right. And remember, you can never apply too much water to a nuclear reaction. I don't know what that means. All right. Moving on to Jan. Jan has a tip, perhaps a little more geeky. He said, I had a small victory worth sharing. My Magic Mouse scroll wheel was not working anymore. The rest was fine. I was able to move the mouse and click, but I couldn't use it to scroll. Looking in the mouse preference pane, the mouse was recognized as a generic one with just two cursors set to speed and something else that I don't remember, maybe click delay. Going to the Bluetooth menu or Bluetooth preference pane, I could not disable Bluetooth. I decided to simply kill the Blue D process and rerun it, and that did the trick. The mouse was back with scroll wheel and full preference pane with the demo video and all of that. From the command line, he issued two commands. Number one was sudo space kill all space Blue D. That's an easy way to kill a process if you know its name but not its process ID, is that kill all command. And then once that succeeded, he hit enter. And once that succeeded, he typed Blue D, B-L-U-E-D, which is the Blue Daemon, whatever people want to call it. The background process that runs and manages Bluetooth. And he just typed it again, and it fired it off, and then everything worked. So that a restart, of course, would have likely fixed this. But it's always better if you can find the needle in the haystack without taking too long. It can be fun. So Jan, thanks for that. Fun, right, John?
Yeah, a few things about that. So you were, I was going to talk about the differences between the kill commands, but you already brought that up here. But I want to mention a few other things. So one, I'm curious as to how Jan knew that it was Blue D. Now, there are a few things here, so I'm going to, and these are useful.
Yeah.
Trust me on this here.
I'll trust
one,
you.
You can, it's not going to be an irrelevant tangent. This is definitely a relevant tangent here, but how do you know that how did he know Blue D would do it? I mean, the name kind of implies it. So anything that ends with D is a daemon or a background process. So you could go to Activity Monitor and look at things, and anything that ends in a D, you may be able to guess what it is for. And killing it off to, you know, because a lot of daemons, when they get killed off, you'll then, they'll start themselves up again and fix problems, like in this case. But you could say, you could go in the terminal and say, man, Blue D, and it'll tell you, well, that's the Bluetooth daemon. And by the way, the user can't directly use it.
Right.
But you can kill it, but you can't use it. But then I want to mention a utility. I don't know if they've updated it in a while here, but one thing that I liked about it, or still like about it, Dave, it's a utility called App Monitor. And the nice thing about App Monitor is that when it lists processes, if you highlight it, if there is a man page, will explain to you what it does. So, two things there to help you dig in to help debug problems like this.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
App Monitors is something I haven't mentioned for a while, but again, it does this. If you highlight something.
AT Monitor, right?
AT Monitor is the name of the program.
All right. I'm trying to pull up the webpage here to put it in the chat room at macgeekab.com/stream, and I don't, their website does not seem to come up. So.
Oh, goodness. And it looks like it hasn't been updated for a while.
I was
but
just
going to
say, this might be on one of those here. One of those legacy apps that just so happens to continue to work. Yep.
Okay, but the man page will always work. You just have to go to the terminal.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. Cool. I wanted to point out with the kill all command, it can be really handy in a way that perhaps you might use it more frequently or more regularly is if, say, you need to kill the finder. You can just go to the terminal and type kill all space finder, and that will kill the finder. And then, as John said, some of these things, and the finder usually is one of them, will relaunch itself. If the finder doesn't, just click on the finder icon in the dock, and that will relaunch it, unless there's something worse going on with your system, in which case, no, it won't. So, yeah. All right. And then moving on to actually a question from John, you before we move on to this question, you had a little story to share of a story of success, right?
A tale of woe and a tale of success.
All right.
So, if you recall, I was having time machine issues.
Yes.
And they all of a sudden went away. And that was because, as far as I'm concerned, it was bugs that they had fixed in the latest Mac OS X update.
In relation to encrypted time machine backups and encrypted disk images.
There were disk image issues. So they fixed a disk image issue and a encryption issue. And I think the combination of the two was causing my grief because they would... Yeah, they would just not pass verification. But sure. Then, so I've been going for a couple of weeks now, and everything's been great.
Mm-hmm.
Then all of a sudden, I got the same error just this morning. And I'm like, oh, man. So I look in the console. So backup D is the time machine process. So I looked at backup D, and it said, yeah, I had a problem finding this file. It was like an address book file or something, but it had a problem. And I think what happened is it abandoned the disk image and corrupted it. Okay.
Okay.
So this is different from before. So this is, and this can happen, probably more likely with a wireless connection than a wired connection. But it just barfed and corrupted the disk image. I found this article, which is a great article, and I'll paste it here. But it's basically the title of the article, and even though it's dated, kind of like the thing I mentioned before, it worked. The recommendation worked. This was actually written in 2011, but it's called Fixed Time Machine Sparse Bundle NAS-Based Backup Errors. And that's exactly what I had.
Sounds like a problem. You know, I have been getting, I back up my iMac in the office to three different time machine destinations here in kind of split between the office and the house. And two of them this week went belly up with that same message. So I wonder if there was something with the 10.11.5 update that made it more, if part of these sparse bundle fixes also sort of highlighted maybe some underlying issues with those. Oh, yeah. So the article you have is the garth.org article, which is, yes, the sort of canonical canonical article about fixing these things. I've used Garth's things. We've talked about this particular article on the show a few times in many years ago, but yeah, this is the one, man. Okay. Yep.
I've never had to use it, but there are three major steps. One is to change the permissions on the file, because what happens is it gets marked as read only. So you want to fix that.
Okay.
The second thing is that you run fsck_hfs on the image. And I had to run it a couple of times before it fixed it. And then you also have to edit a plist file because Time Machine also notes the fact that something terrible happened. But you can edit that out.
Right.
And then once I did this, I actually did a backup and it worked fine. It purged some old entries. And then it decided, because I think it still detected something bad happened recently, it ran the verification again and it passed it. So,
Okay.
You don't want to use disk utility on a sparse bundle. That will not work. Because I tried that, and it said, oh, yep, everything's fine. But it's not. You need to do this FSCK step. That's the tool that can detect and repair the damage. So just wanted to share that.
I will tell you, recently, and when I say recently, I mean for several years, our advice has been, if you have a corruption problem with your Time Machine backup, accept it, let it rebuild it and move on. Right. And I have tried this Garth solution before, as I mentioned, and it does, it will fix it. But usually this problem is going to come back. So I'm curious if this fix is a one-time thing for you, or if within the next month you encounter this again and then again and then again, and finally just decide to punt and let it rebuild. But my advice is as always, I mean, you know, as I said, when we were talking about Jan's thing, you know, finding the needle in the haystack, that's fun. Right. But, if you value your time, you might just wind up punting anyway. You know.
Yeah, I'll keep you posted.
Yeah,
the thing is, I also schedule now a regular CCC backup of this machine.
Yay!
The thing is, I used to kind of do... So the thing is, I just kind of used to do it whenever I remembered, because I don't have the backup drive connected to this machine, because it's my portable.
Got
I do
it.
On my Mini.
Right, right.
And my Mini runs it every... You know, every morning, and it's kind of cool because it has power nap, so it actually runs it.
Sure.
In the background.
Yeah.
I tell it to.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah. So I've scheduled a backup, a CCC backup, and what'll happen is that, you know, I think I set it up so it'll prompt me. It'll be like, can you plug in your backup drive, please? So,
cool. Hey, I've got to talk about something that. That I'm very excited about. So, you know, years ago we started talking about power line, right? Because we needed to find a way to get essentially Ethernet type signals from one part of our homes to the other. And lately I mentioned, you know, in the fall that I had to move on past power line because the, power line wouldn't go as fast as my internet speeds would, right? You know, power line for me was maxing out at about 80, maybe to 100 megabits per second. My internet speeds downstream are about 150, so I was missing out. And so I stopped using power line, but, you know, as we mentioned, and it's like Eero does, 802.11ac, if you're using that as a backbone between two routers, you can actually get, you know, decent speeds. And I was getting even... you know, two floors away, other corner of the house, you know, still getting somewhere between 300 and 500 megabits per second, which is much better than the 80 to 100. But it's, you know, if you're doing it with Eero, which we mentioned last week, well, that seems to be pretty rock solid. But if you're managing your own wireless bridge, well, frankly, there's a reason Eero exists, right? Because managing your own wireless bridge is a little bit of a headache. So I've been searching for something else. If you want to have this Ethernet type connection, and John, I have found it. Yeah, MoCA, right? So you have to have coax cables in both places. Now, I will preface this conversation by saying that I have some of the oldest and worst coax cables strung throughout my house. These are not most of these were not done by professionals. They were done either mostly actually by the previous homeowner. So there's kind of stuff that's everywhere. And some of the connectors are, you know, it's either connectors that I've made with a crimping tool or, you know, not pro connectors. So MoCA does what Powerline does, except instead of it sending an Ethernet type signal across your AC jacks, it sends it across your coax. And I am astounded with how reliable this is over even my crummy connections. So there's three levels of MoCA really that are available. There's the MoCA 1.x, which we'll call, and that can go pretty fast. That can get you real world speeds of up to about 200 megabits per second. And that's what I was getting when I was doing that between my two TiVo units, because most TiVo units support MoCA. Then there's MoCA 2.0. which goes quite a bit faster than that, typically about double, maybe even faster than that. And so MoCA 2.0 can go close to 500, maybe even faster. I was getting my TiVo Mini is a MoCA 1.1 unit. My TiVo Bolt is a MoCA 2 unit. And I know that when the TiVo Bolt is connected to another MoCA 2 unit, it gets, like I said, close to 500 megabits per second. So this is a good speed, right? ActionTech, though, has created what they call a bonded MoCA 2 adapter. And so this uses the MoCA 2 protocol, but on more than one channel. As far as I understand it, it's similar to what we get on our cable modems when we move from DOCSIS 2 to DOCSIS 3. You're just using more channels simultaneously in a bonded way. And I plugged in two of these adapters, John. You can get them for $150 for a pair of these things, right? So they're not cost prohibitive if you're, you know, especially if you're comparing it to running drops in your walls with Ethernet cable. You won't get an electrician to even look at your house for $150, let alone, you know, do anything. And on my first test, you know, these things, and again, the worst two connections, this is without me even going and putting the right splitters in the right places. I was getting over 800 megabits a second between these adapters. So that's, I mean, some of you might get speeds over a gigabit if you've got better cabling than I do. So it's pretty impressive. And I'll put a link to these two adapters or this pair of adapters in the show notes, but I'm pretty excited about it, as you can tell, because it's just another option for us all. So,
yeah, I'm curious what you have running in your house. I mean, I'm looking at a few pieces I got kicking around the office here, and I got one that is listed as CATV 18AWG, and it looks like a pretty decent.
No, I've got pretty thin cables. It doesn't matter. You know, it is what I've found with the Mocha stuff is that, you know, as long as you've got cables that would send a TV signal, that pretty much is right, all it needs, which is cool, right? Yeah, it's I'm just blown away, and I feel kind of silly for not having opened the doors to Mocha in the past. So,
all right, yeah. So you think if you had better, if you reran the cable, which you're probably not going to want to do.
If I was going to rerun cable, I would then also run Ethernet along with it. And I could, right? I mean, that's the thing is, because I have coax drops to these places, I've thought about it. And I thought, well, if I really wanted to do this right, I could just, you know, pull that coax through the wall a little bit, tie another piece of coax and some Ethernet to it, and make, you know, when you do that, you know it's going to go through walls, you tape it up like crazy, but you also kind of make a you make sort of a point on it so that it can slip through connections or slip through wall joints and things like that. And I would just pull Ethernet up through the wall. And I thought about that, actually, but I wanted to test this too, and was like, well, if this works, then what do I need that for? Like, right. I'm not going to get that much better. I'll get maybe another 100 megabits. So,
and I think these days, if you're going to run Ethernet cable, then I think all the cool kids are using what is referred to as Cat 6, which I believe can handle, is guaranteed to handle gigabit Ethernet and maybe even more.
No, Cat 5 will do gigabit, I believe, and 6 will do 10 gigabit, right? I think that's right. But yes. Yeah, if you're going to run cable, absolutely run Cat 6. Yeah. You don't, this is not, well, as I said, you know, if you've got cable there already, it makes it a little easier. It can make it a lot easier. It's even easier if you also, along with your cable, run a piece of string, because that gives you something else there in the wall. But, yeah, it's possible. So,
or you could use the string to connect to cans.
Yes, that's right.
Use that.
Yeah, that works even in power outages, John.
No power required.
No power required. All right. So, speaking of Eero, Matt has a question, and actually, we got a ton of questions about Eero. It's probably the biggest response to a sponsor I've ever heard. But which is great. I mean, it was a good fit, you know, or is a good fit, I should say. Matt writes. He says, "I was excited to hear about your new Wi-Fi about Eero," he says. "I've heard good things about them, but one thing to be aware of is that from what I've heard about them, or maybe similar products, is that because of the way they use their mesh network and authenticate, if you lose your internet connectivity, you can't actually use your Wi-Fi within your local network. Is this true? Can you test this?" And it seemed suspect to me, and I'm glad Matt asked the question. So I did test it. I simply went over and unplugged the Eero from the internet and then restarted both my computer and my phone, and they instantly connected to the Eero network and got an IP address from Eero, and everything worked just fine. So having an internet connection is not mandatory for using your local network when you've got Eero set up. What it is necessary for is making changes to your Eero configuration, because that does sort of go through the cloud. But you don't need it to set it up. It actually sets up. It's pretty cool, John, the way it sets up with Bluetooth. and you just get your phone close to the device, and it finds it and then configures it and adds it to your Eero Mesh. So and then they talk to each other with Wi-Fi, of course. So yeah.
And Dave, you know, speaking of wireless,
yeah,
I thought I'd let some people know here if they haven't, but if you are still using, well, I am using an AirPort, though yeah. I'm not using it as my primary. Of course, I'm using I'm using the TP
Link.
But I still do have an AirPort Express downstairs that I use for AirPlay. And I noticed the other day I was walking by and I see the yellow light flashing, which with a lot of Apple wireless devices, that means something bad happened. In this case, it wasn't that something bad happened. What it was saying, once I ran the AirPort utility, is, hey guys, there's a firmware update. And I just want to mention this to people because the firmware update seems to address some issues that we have had reported to us in the past. One of the issues is, so it's update 7.7.7, and I think it's 7.7.7. Well, yeah. I found the page here, but it addresses some issues. So one, Dave, is communication between clients on the same network. Because I know we've had people say, you know, I got two things on an Apple wireless thing, and they just don't talk to each other. So it addresses that. Some guest network stuff, which I don't care about because I don't use that. But then also Bonjour Sleep Proxy issues. And we've also had people report issues where, and this usually manifests itself in that you start getting devices with names blah, 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 one, blah, 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 two, blah, 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 three. So update your firmware on your Apple AirPort and you may be happier.
Yeah. Yeah. I was surprised to see a firmware update for devices that old, but, but, you know, it works. Yeah. It's crazy. It's good, though. Along those lines, it's probably worth mentioning that some reports came out this weekend talking about how Apple pulled all of the AirPort routers, time capsules, whatever, from their store shelves just the other day. And, you know, with WWDC right around the corner, there is some understandable speculation that, oh, it means new AirPorts, which it could. But this week is also the week that June 2nd is upon us. And June 2nd is that deadline after which companies cannot sell routers that don't adhere to all of the new FCC regulations. And it probably will require a software update. But if the devices on Apple shelves did not have that update in them, they could not sell them after June 2nd. So it's, again, it's also possible that this is just so that they can get them in house and then make sure the software is updatable. From what I understand, you can still order them on the online store, and which makes sense because Apple has those at least somewhere under their control and they can make sure that they're shipping them the right way. So who knows what's coming at WWDC, but I just kind of wanted to put some perspective on that. So, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. While we're here, we just mentioned one of last week's sponsors, and I might as well point out that coupon code MGG with Eero, even though they're not technically a sponsor of this episode, it still gets you free overnight shipping. So if you're interested in that, certainly take advantage of that. That's why we have it for you. But I want to talk about this week's sponsors, if that's okay with you, John.
Okay.
All right. Our first sponsor today is Power Photos from Fat Cat Software. I'm going to tell you right up front, visit fatcatsoftware.com/MGG and then use coupon code MGG to get 20% off both Power Photos and iPhoto Library Manager. You buy a bundled license. It's $29. And so you save $6. Off of that. And it's a great deal on a killer piece of software. In fact, I was just using it this week. I finally upgraded my wife's machine from Yosemite to El Capitan. And even though she was already on Photos, Photos wanted to update again. Of course, I store her Photos library on a network drive. We're not going to discuss the relative merits of doing that, but certainly in this case, having it on a network drive was bad because it would not upgrade the library. So I had to copy the library back over. It wouldn't let me. This was a problem. There was some kind of permission issue. So the first thing I did was I launched Power Photos on her machine, pointed it at that library, and I could see all my pictures. this was a good sign. I was able to get in there and I could even pull pictures out if I wanted to. This saved me from having to do all kinds of other crazy things. I was able to get the library moved over to a local drive connected to her machine, of course. And then from there, Photos did the upgrade for me. But having Power Photos really gave me the ability to do lots of things. More than that, gave me the peace of mind at being able to see my library and say, okay, or her library, which is really our family library, and say, okay, everything's good. I'm still storing the thing locally on her on a drive attached to her machine. And I may not stop doing that because I think it's easier to manage this stuff when it's local. You need to have Power Photos to do that. You need it to eliminate duplicates. You need it if you want to merge libraries together or copy photos back and forth between libraries, or if you want to split up a library into pieces. All these things that Photos just doesn't do. You need Power Photos for this. The price is right. You got a good deal. Again, fatcatsoftware.com/MGG. Coupon code MGG saves you 20%. Our thanks to Fat Cat Software for sponsoring this episode. You ever been frustrated trying to buy tickets online? I buy tickets all the time, and I'm a pro at this. I'm as much of a pro as any consumer ticket buyer could be. And I'll tell you what, there is an app called SeatGeek that has saved me many times in the past, and I am so happy to have them on board as a sponsor. Again, this is an app. You can run it on your iPhone. You can run it on your Android phone. And coupon code MGG saves you $20 after you make your first ticket purchase. So you want to go download the free SeatGeek app. And then what it does is it pulls all the available ticket deals from all the other sites into one place. So not only can you see them all at once, you can set alerts so that you know when more tickets come available. It becomes your friend, frankly. And when I'm looking for tickets to an event that I didn't buy when it went right on sale, SeatGeek is the app that I use because it pulls it all into one place. I don't have to check everybody else. Here's the thing. SeatGeek is always honest and upfront about the price. Unlike StubHub, SeatGeek shows you the full ticket price from start to finish and never surprises you with huge fees at checkout. So this is an app that I could not live without as a crazy concert goer. Of course, you can use it for sports tickets or theater tickets, whatever you want. But I use it for concerts because that's where I spend all my extra money. $20 you get by using promo code MGG. You download the app. We got a link in the show notes, but it's called SeatGeek. And then you go to the settings tab and you click add a promo code MGG. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Our sincere thanks to SeatGeek for sponsoring this episode. So happy to have them on board. I'll be honest, running a business is a lot of fun, but there's also parts of it that aren't that much fun. And FreshBooks aims to take one of those things that most people don't find fun and make it easy. I actually like accounting, but that means that I've had the opportunity to check out a lot of different things. FreshBooks is outstanding at what they do. They're really focused. You could use it for any size business. I'll say that. But they're really focused on the small business, especially what they like to call, and now I like to call, the solopreneur. You got into business to do something, but part of that is you've got to bill people for your time. You've got to track your time. You've got to track your expenses. FreshBooks makes all of this really, really easy. Invoicing. There's no easier way to create an invoice. FreshBooks makes it happen for you in like 30 seconds. And then it tracks that invoice. So if somebody's not paying, you can actually have FreshBooks send them an email. FreshBooks will let you take credit cards right in the system there. So makes it easier for your customers to pay. Guess what? That's a good thing. I know you know this. This is how it works. So you got to check out FreshBooks. It'll let you track your expenses. It's so easy to forget to track those things. FreshBooks, they have an app. You can just log the stuff right there. And then you have to, I don't want to say you don't have to think about it, but you don't have to remember it. FreshBooks will remind you when you go in and look at your expenses, there it is. And then you can remember, oh, right, I got to track that to, company A's invoice and all of this stuff. It's awesome. You got to check it out. Go to FreshBooks.com/MGG and then enter Mac Geek Gab in the How Did You Hear About Us section. And you get 30 days for free. Again, that's FreshBooks.com/MGG. Answer Mac Geek Gab when they ask you how you heard about them. They know we sent you, and you get 30 days for free. Our thanks to FreshBooks for sponsoring this episode.
Hey, John and Dave, this is Matt, and listening to the latest episode and your discussion around Adam and his mysterious phone calls. And, you know, this whole conversation got me to thinking about something, and I don't know if this is a sign that I've been listening to Dave a little bit too long, and maybe some of the conspiracy theory stuff is starting to take hold, but, you know, why is it that cell phones in pockets never manage to do anything but call other people embarrassingly? You know, there's a theory that says that if you put enough monkeys in a room for a long enough time, their random banging away at the keyboards will produce the collected works of Shakespeare or whatever the case may be. So why is it that cell phones in pockets never manage to hack into my bank account and add millions of dollars or produce the works of Shakespeare, do anything else useful? They only manage to embarrass you by calling someone and letting them eavesdrop on whatever thing you might be doing at the time. You know, it's got to be a conspiracy of some sort. I just haven't been able to figure out by whom and to what end. So I don't know. Maybe we should all be very careful to avoid getting caught.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. The pocket dial conspiracy, Matthew, that's it's real. Our troubles are real for sure. You know, John, I emotionally support all conspiracy theories, regardless of whether or not I intellectually support them. My emotional support is solid, and including with this one, I cheer it on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Chemtrails.
Chemtrails. Yes.
What about those?
That's so the chemtrails, they're using the pocket dials on the iPhone to target the chemtrails, I think. Right, John?
Exactly.
Yes. Yes. All right. Why don't we move to Terry, John, and start answering some questions here?
Let's answer a question. So Terry has a simple question.
Cool.
But the answer isn't. Well, no, I think it's a simple answer. Multiple answers. One question, I'm going to give you more than one answer. So
we would expect nothing less.
And they're probably going to be mostly correct. So, hi, Dave and John. Do you know of any way to change the default location of my web receipts folder so it uses iCloud instead of my local disk? Now, we need to explain what the heck is this question asking, because standing on its own, people may not know what the heck is going on here.
Yeah.
The thing is, there is something called the Web Receipts folder. Actually, I didn't know this because I don't really use it. Now, how do you get to it? And what is it for? I'm going to tell you what it's for. So if you go in pretty much any application and you go to File and Print, you're going to get a print menu. And normally you're going to get a list of printers. But then in the lower left-hand corner, you're going to see a little thing saying PDF. PDF is portable document format, which is a nice, pretty standard way to represent documents.
I think it's safe to say most folks know what a PDF is.
I just thought I'd help out.
Yeah.
So anyways, PDF is, and it's good to save. So rather than printing to a printer, you can actually save the content to a PDF file and then look at it later, like open it with Preview or whatever. A whole bunch of programs can deal with PDFs. But then in this menu, if you click on it, it's going to have an option saying save PDF to Web Receipts folder. And I'd never used this or seen this before. Or I may have seen it, but I never used it. What does it do? It actually saves the PDF in a folder, which it will create if it's not there, in your documents folder called Web Receipts. So there's the background. Now, the question is, what if you don't want to save it there? What if you want to save it somewhere else? And the question here, so this answer I think is close, Dave. So the question is, how do I save it to iCloud? Now, I think one answer here. Now, I'm going to give one answer. And one answer would be, so when you bring up this print menu, you're going to say print. And instead of saying save to Web Receipts, why don't you say save as PDF? And that's one of the choices, dot, dot, dot. Dot, dot, dot means, oh, well, you know, I'm going to give you a chance to give me some more options here. And what I would do, Dave, is when you get this, you're going to see a file dialog. And in the left-hand corner is going to be what you also see in your Finder. And one of them is iCloud Drive. So you could choose that. Now, the thing is, you may not see iCloud Drive in the sidebar. How do you see that? The thing is, you may choose not to see it. Now, to reveal it, you go to the Finder. And let's see. I think it's Finder View Options. They always put it in a wacky place here. Nope, not View Options. I'm sorry. Finder.
That's in Finder Preferences. Yep.
And then there's going to be a sidebar category. And one of the things you can list in the favorites area is iCloud Drive, assuming that you use iCloud Drive. So to me, that would be a quick answer, but you may want to get a bit more sophisticated.
Well, yeah, I think you might want to build a workflow so that it automatically saves to your preferred folder. I mean, that's what we do with our Evernote stuff, right? We answer like Terry's question via email and then send it. You can in that menu, you can add things to that menu, and you can add automator workflows and or Apple scripts, whatever you want. And it'll take the PDF in and do whatever you want with it. You want to tell them where your where that folder is, John?
Well, the thing is there is some additional guidance. So one is that there is a article on the Apple developer site called Creating PDF Workflow Options. And it gives you a number of different things that you can do here. Now, Apple does provide, now this made me sad, because if you look in your library/PDF services folder, you should see, it's bundled with OS X, something called Save PDF to Web Receipts Folder.pdf workflow. The thing is, I couldn't figure how to create that or even edit it in Xcode or look at the contents of it. I thought, oh, well, I'll open that up and just, you know, change where it sends stuff. But it seems they provide it, but they don't provide a way or guidance how to build it. But as Dave said, there are ways to, in that folder, put a workflow. So one is you could use Automator. Another thing you could do, as my esteemed colleague pointed out, is that he actually built one. And so I pointed to this article, and this is a dandy article called Use Apple Script to Create a Custom Evernote PDF Menu Action, written by this Dave Hamilton fellow. So you can use that as guidance as well to create a workflow that'll be a bit more specific as to where you would like to store this. If what I mentioned, iCloud Drive, isn't quite what you want, though I think it may be.
Yeah, it's fairly simple to create these actions or these Apple scripts to do it. Reading the article that I did should help kind of show you the path, but you can do them in Automator too. And then you just save them. John pointed to the library PDF services folder. That certainly will populate the menu in the print dialog, but also home library PDF services, which is probably the place you want to put this stuff, unless you want this available to all the users on your computer, which you might. So you build your little either workflow or Apple script, and then you put it there. And as long as it is built to accept a PDF, then you can tell it to do whatever you want with it. And it's very, very straightforward to do this stuff. And you can really, I mean, it's probably the easiest way, or certainly the quickest way, to sort of experience customizing your Mac in sort of a deeper way. By doing that, because there are those things you're constantly, you know, it, well, many of us are constantly, you know, gathering data. And if you can gather it in the form of a PDF and put it where you want, it's great. The other way to do this would be if you don't want to, you know, mess around with programming. And this is very light programming, but it is programming. If you don't want to mess around with that, then I would recommend using Hazel. And have Hazel watch your web receipts folder and take anything that that it sees put in there and move it to one of your iCloud Drive folders. And then that would just deal with it. And it would be, frankly, quite a bit easier to do that and much faster to set that up. But so, you know, and would accomplish the same result. You just tell it, you know, you'd use the built-in save to web receipts workflow and it would save it there. And then Hazel would say, hey, I see something was saved here, and it would move it over to wherever you want. And Hazel's really, really straightforward to use. It's one of those apps that it kind of sits there and I forget that I have it right up until I, you know, either set up a new machine or, you know, something happens and it's not running anymore. And it's like, wait, how come all my stuff's not going where I expect it to go? It's nice to have it manage your downloads folder. It clean, you can have it clean out your old downloads and or failed downloads and all that stuff. It's really a handy piece of software. So I highly, highly, highly recommend that, even if you're not going to use it for this purpose. So there you go. That's my story on that, John.
And you're sticking to it.
I will. Yeah. Hazel's something I will stick to. All right. Moving on to Joan here. Joan asks a question, not for the first time on this show, but it is good to revisit this stuff. She said, I'm writing to ask a question that I, Yeah. Okay. She said she found my article about how to safely disable iCloud Photo Library. And she asked if in fact any of these steps have changed, and the answer, and I wrote this article, what, a year ago, I think, John, it was last May that I wrote this, last June, but, she was asking, you know, she has iCloud Photo Library on, she needs the space. Actually, her problem is she needs the space on her phone, because it's filling up her 16 gig iPhone. Even though it's only storing thumbnails locally, those thumbnails do take up space. And so she wanted to make sure she could disable iCloud Photo Library on her phone without deleting any content. And she wanted to disable iCloud Photo Library altogether. And yeah, it's a bit of a pedantic process. And we'll put a link in the show notes to the article that I wrote about it. But it's really straightforward. You know, you... It, for the most part, you just uncheck iCloud Photo Library on your devices, you know, and then you need to go to each of your phones and import all those photos into your Mac that it doesn't have. In theory, if iCloud Photo Library was working properly, you would already have them because it would have uploaded them to iCloud Photo Library and then you would have downloaded them. But because you just turned all this off, if anything didn't quite, you know, make it, you want to go ahead and get each of those. So you just do the import. It's no big deal. Disable iCloud Photo Library on your devices. And then in theory, your Mac's photo library will have everything that was on it and on the devices. But it's not a guarantee that you have everything that was in your iCloud Photo Library, because your iCloud Photo Library, as Joan found, will store things in the cloud and won't necessarily have everything on your devices. It might just have thumbnails. So you can actually, even once you have disabled iCloud Photo Library, even if you have canceled it, it will still keep your photos online for 30 days. So you can go and download all of your photos from iCloud Photo Library and then import those into your into photos on the Mac, and it'll handle duplicates. Obviously, you know me, I'm going to recommend Power Photos to handle the duplicates because that's what I trust to do this stuff. But you know, that's the step. So there you go. But it's pretty straightforward. You don't use iCloud Photo Library, right, John?
I did. And the one thing I can say, Dave, so the thing is it, I think it was when I did a major iOS upgrade.
Yeah.
Unbeknownst to me, it turned on iCloud Photo Library. The only reason I realized this was at some point I got warnings. It was like, by the way, you're kind of running out of space on your iCloud drive.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm like, well, how could that be? And then I thought back and it's like, oh, well, you know what? I just made some videos on my phone. And apparently it was like, oh, well, I better upload those videos up to the, you know, your storage there.
Yeah.
And that set off it warned me that I was running out of space. So then I turned it off. And the one thing I can tell you is that if you log in pretty much to iCloud from most devices, it made sure to warn me no matter where I was. It's like, oh, yeah, by the way, in 30 days, you're going to lose a lot of stuff.
Right, so right. That's true.
It's very persistent in warning you that you will lose things. There's really no way to avoid it that right. I could find. It was kind of annoying after a while. I'm like, okay, I get that things are going to disappear after 30 days. Can you not keep
telling me? Yeah, the defense stipulates that the photos will be deleted. Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, No, but it's good. It you know, it works. That part of iCloud Photo Library works well. Frankly, PhotoStream is kind of a mess. I still can't get all of my Macs to see all of the photos on my PhotoStream. And you folks may not realize this because I've seen it happening on many people's Macs. If you go into your iPhone or your iPad, or certainly if I go into my iPhone or iPad and I go to my PhotoStream, I go into albums, I can see that there's 1,000 pictures in my PhotoStream. On some of my Macs, there will be 350. On another Mac, it might be 808. They don't all show the same number. So I open photos on my, you know, on my main Mac all the time. So I don't know why it wouldn't show me the same number, 1,000 pictures, which is the maximum in PhotoStream. And sometimes if you turn off PhotoStream, you know, you go in on your Mac, you go into Photos, you go to Preferences, iCloud, and in there you can turn PhotoStream off and then turn it back on. Sometimes that'll trigger it to download more, but it doesn't always get them all. It's kind of a mess. But so that's why, you know, that import, whenever I plug my phone into my Mac, I always open Photos and say, import any photos on this, you know, device that aren't in my library. And it will, there are always photos that it's pulling in. So PhotoStream is not the end all be all. But from what I have seen, iCloud Photo Library is. If you're willing to pay for the storage, both on iCloud and on your device, at least for the thumbnails. If you have a phone, if you have a phone larger than 16 gigs, you're probably going to be fine in terms of that. But it is worth knowing. But if you're willing to pay for the storage on iCloud, everyone that I know that's been using iCloud Photo Library has been very, very happy with it. PhotoStream is not a good PhotoStream's reliability or lack thereof is not a good indicator of the same with iCloud Photo Library. From what I've seen, everybody finds iCloud Photo Library very, very reliable. So
the only thing I'll mention, and I found to be mostly true, and Apple buries this fact, and I verified it on and off. They bury this fact, but the thing is, PhotoStream is, if you take a picture on your iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch, is conditional on a couple of things. And I'll just read the relevant line here, and then we'll link to the article that talks about PhotoStream as well. But they say, photos that you take on your iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch will automatically upload to my PhotoStream when you leave the camera app and connect to Wi-Fi.
That makes sense. So it's not uploading them. So you can triage photos in the moment. If you take a photo and you're like, oh, that was crap, you delete it, it's not going to bother to upload that to PhotoStream. That makes sense.
Right, because I've seen this happen. I'm like, sure. Well, why aren't my photos uploading? And it's like, oh, I'm either not on Wi-Fi or the camera app is still open.
Right.
And I think this is still true. I haven't verified it recently, but the last time I was scratching my head over why the photos didn't make it, it was because I wasn't doing these things. So,
yeah, there's more reasons why photos don't make it, and they are not in this FAQ. They are simply, it's just buggy.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
Or yeah. iCloud. The explanation is iCloud.
Yeah, it's just weird to me. I mean, you know, I have expressed my issues with Apple's, with some of Apple's cloud services. Many of them actually work fine. You know, we don't complain about CalDAV or CardDAV here very often, either from our own experiences or from yours, because that stuff just works. It's extremely reliable. iCloud Drive, similarly, works really, really well. Syncing of, you know, third-party data, syncing of, especially, you know, PhotoStream, not so much. You know, there are issues with Apple's cloud, but it seems weird to me that PhotoStream would have inconsistencies that iCloud Photo Library does not. I would expect the two to be, you know, to share a similar engine, right? I mean, it seems to me, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Anyway. All right, moving along. Michael, that's a good question. It's a basic question, but that's okay. We don't have to be overly geeky all the time. He says, I finally broke down and bought an Apple Watch on eBay for $200. Setting it up was easy. The person I bought it from, except they hadn't removed their account. Once that was resolved, everything's been fine. He says, I've only played with it for a few days, but I find that the screen with all the tiny icons is pretty useless. Is there a way to limit the number of icons that show up there? Is there a good how-to tutorial for the watch? Lastly, do you guys have favorite apps you have found over time to be useful? How do I change what shows up on the face and which face shows up when I turn the watch on? And he apologizes for asking simple questions, but it's good to go through this stuff because if you have them, somebody else has them too, Michael. So I'll go through a couple of these and hopefully the answers will sort of open some doors and find you in places where you'll have the options. But it is managing the watch is an interesting paradigm because you do some of it on the watch and you do some of it on your phone. So as for controlling the layout and the number of apps, you can do some of this right on the watch if you like by tapping and holding on one of the apps. So you'll hit the digital crown. That'll get you to this from the watch face to the screen with all the apps, the app layout. Tap and hold on one of the apps and you'll get into what I call jiggly jiggly mode, which just like the iPhone where the apps, you know, kind of wiggle around and there's little X's and you can delete them from there. But it's amazingly, intensely frustrating to try and do this on the watch in my experience. So I do it on the phone in the Apple Watch app. So you go into the Apple Watch app and you go to app layout and then you can see all your apps and you can do kind of the same thing here. You can move them around, but you cannot remove them from this section. You can remove them by going down. And as you scroll down in the Apple Watch app on your phone, you'll see a listing for every app that can be installed on your watch. And if you go into one of those, you'll see show app on Apple Watch, and you can turn that slider on or off. I think that's pretty obvious. And if the app has the ability to be shown in what's called glances, which are the things where you can swipe up from the bottom, it will have an option for that there too. One piece of advice, if you are getting frustrated with stuff just being barfed out onto your watch, you might want to go again on your iPhone into the Apple Watch app, go into general and disable automatic app install. What happens is if you download an app to your iPhone that includes an Apple Watch counterpart, that counterpart will automatically be installed on your watch if this option is on, if automatic app install is enabled. Really, though, that's the only way you'll know that an Apple Watch app exists unless you start digging. So if you're going to turn this off, just be aware that you might be missing out on some things if you don't regularly kind of go into the Apple Watch app on your phone and scroll through and say, oh, hey, I haven't seen that before. I might want that on my watch. As for watch faces, that you do on the watch itself with your watch showing the time. Force tap on the, or force push, whatever we call that nowadays, on the watch face, and it'll pop up a little configuration utility, if you will, where it'll say customize at the bottom. You can scroll around actually at that point, scroll left to right to find all different manner of watch faces, and then you can hit the customize button at the bottom to add different complications to them. So you can set up all sorts of different watch faces that you might use for different purposes and then scroll around between them. When you've got things where you want, lightly tap it and that'll kind of activate it and bring it back to the surface. So hopefully that helps. Happy to answer simple questions here. It's always good to kind of get the foundations down. So thank you for asking that, Michael.
I have a simple question.
Yeah, what's that?
Can you do any watch management at all from iTunes?
No.
Okay.
No, 100% is from your iPhone.
Okay, because I remember, because if you want to rearrange icons on your iPhone, you can use iTunes to do that. I wasn't sure if it extended to the watch, but the answer is no.
No. Okay. No. Yeah, no. No, there's no watch management from your Mac at all. In fact, that's interesting. I mean, it kind of makes sense. It's a, you know, it's a mobile device, but yeah. Yeah, you've got, and you have to have an iPhone to use the watch for these and other reasons, right? You have to have the
that
right
kind
iPhone.
Of explains it.
Yeah,
I just thought it was a nice feature again when they allowed you to manage the arrangement of things on your iOS device, except for the watch, using iTunes.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, but managing, I like that idea in theory. I have never enjoyed managing my app layout. I haven't ever enjoyed managing the app layout of the apps on my iPhone ever. With any interface, But doing it in iTunes, it's just so slow. I mean, you drag things around and it waits forever. And then sometimes they bounce back. I don't know. It feels like it's a process that's just, you know, fraught with frustration. I always just do it.
I find it frustrating on the phone itself, because typically the thing that I want to move somewhere else pushes something I don't want to be pushed out of the way.
Yeah. At least if you do it on the phone, it will stick. Whereas I found, I mean, I've spent hours, maybe not hours, but dozens of minutes managing, you know, a layout for my phone from iTunes, and you hit apply, and then suddenly half the stuff that you removed, it puts back. 'Cause it's like, no, I found this on your phone. It's like, yeah, but that was the point. Take it off the phone. So it feels like there's always something missing there. I don't know. It's not a great, it's not a great thing. Alex in the chat room is saying that he finds iTunes very responsive when managing his phone that way. So maybe it's just me. Maybe I just have too many apps, which is entirely possible. Yeah. All right. Chuck's got a good one. I love questions like this. So Chuck says, I've used Migration Assistant from a Time Machine backup to import data and settings from my wife's old MacBook Air to a new machine. Everything worked pretty consistently. Settings for email, network pref, Safari bookmarks, and her documents all moved. But two things did not move as expected: her Apple Calendar data and her contacts data. I had to export the calendar data as a separate step from the old machine, and the program says the data was successfully imported, but it still doesn't show. That then was finally resolved by restarting the calendar app, and all of the data appeared. Then things got even weirder with the contacts app. I tried exporting her contacts, over 800 of them, as a contacts data archive. Nothing showed in the new machine's contacts app once I imported it. The vCard method allowed all of those contacts, but the groups aren't included. I can export all the groups one at a time and then import them to her new computer. However, my wife is a university professor and has literally dozens of groups for classes and research activities. That means dozens of group imports, and then the tediousness of resolving duplicates, which will automatically come from importing groups in this manner. I suppose I could do the reverse and import the individual groups first and then the bulk data. Perhaps that would allow for less work to eliminate duplicates. I've not been able to save her contacts data to iCloud, even though that setting is active in her preferences. But if I can manage to do that, will that allow the import of her contacts and groups at the same time? Apple support suggests that as a way to manage this transition. Yeah, so Apple support is right. I mean, this is all sort of tied together, but this is an interesting dilemma. While I'm usually a fan of just solve the problem, don't obsess over the cause, with this one, my curiosity is kind of going to get the best of me. So let's explore some of this. I think you've got some configuration problems that might plague this machine down the road. So the big question is, where do these problems exist? Are they locally or are they on the cloud? And the reason I ask that is there's two things that concern me. One is that her calendars and contacts data did not automatically come down from iCloud, regardless of what you attempted with import or migration attempts, right? And then the second sort of follow-up to that is that concerns me is that each of those apps required at least a relaunch to display data, even after a manual import. So something's not right here. And I would recommend a few tests. They both involve setting up a test user account, and one test user account for each of these. And you can and should delete these test users after the fact, but test user accounts can be great in this scenario. So the first thing I would do is to create a test user. Do not log it into iCloud, and then manually import your calendars and contacts into that account. Right now, we're testing this to see if there's something wrong with your data, her data, separate from anything that iCloud can do to touch it. So in a test user account without having logged into iCloud, we've removed iCloud from the equation. The second test would be the opposite, with another test user, fresh set of, you know, fresh account, so that there's no, you know, inherited data or anything. Log into iCloud, enable calendar and contact syncing, and see what it brings down without manually importing or migrating anything. My gut says that you have an iCloud syncing problem, and that's therefore causing local problems. iCloud syncing happens in two steps, if I have this right. The first is that it brings the data from iCloud down to your Mac, and then there's an engine on your Mac that compares that data to what you have on the Mac and integrates it, manages, you know, conflicts and all of that stuff. The other thing is to log into iCloud.com and see what data appears there. And you can delete calendar and contact data from there too, which is handy if you feel like, you know, iCloud screwed up. Save a copy of your data locally, delete it from iCloud, re-import locally, and then it, in theory, should sync that data up to iCloud. You, the way you do it in iCloud is for contacts, go to iCloud.com, log in, and choose contacts. There's a gear at the bottom left corner of the screen. Choose the gear, choose select all, and then delete. That'll delete all your contacts. You can always restore data from iCloud too. iCloud keeps some backups for you online. With calendars, it's in a similar spot, but instead of clicking the gear, you click the edit button, and then you can delete individual calendars. And obviously, when you delete a calendar, it deletes all the data along with it. So that's my thought with this. Is we gotta? I think you're gonna need to isolate iCloud away from this problem, and hopefully you can delete the data from iCloud and then let it repopulate that way. But it seems like there's something wrong with iCloud that's just not letting anything happen locally on the machine. That's my thought. I don't know. What do you think, John?
One thing I would do to try to debug this. So in the case of contacts, and the thing is, this is not always the case. One thing you may want to do is to be sure when you open it to go to view, and you're going to want to say show groups. That'll help you determine where the heck all the data came from.
Mm.
The default view is that you won't see the groups. And the thing is, if you don't see the groups, you may not know exactly where the data came from. Like, for example, I'm looking right now, and actually I'm a bit surprised. Actually, I'm not now. So the thing is, I see a bunch of groups here in my contacts. So I see iCloud. Okay, good.
Yep.
I see on my Mac, which bothers me, but then I realize why that happened. No, I recently created a new account on this machine. The thing is, on my Mac, it shows two entries, me and Apple Inc.
Right.
I'm gonna delete those. But the thing is, actually, when I look at the entry for me, it's an icon that was created when I created a new user account on this machine because I had a meltdown. So that's where those came from. Then I also have, Dave, Facebook and LinkedIn. You can link your contacts to Facebook, LinkedIn. And you suggested as much, I think, when you said, you know, look at your internet accounts. I think you said that, right?
No, I didn't. No, this is good. Okay. You're totally right to look here. Yeah, yeah.
Internet accounts, especially if you use Migration Assistant, that stuff may have come over. So if you go to System Preferences, Internet accounts, you can, contacts can be taken from many different sources. Like I mentioned, I take them from Facebook and LinkedIn. In addition, smart. iCloud. So it's smart, but it can be kind of a mess because you may get redundancies and there may be overlaps and stuff like that. The other thing is that at least in contacts, there's something called, this is another thing in the view menu. It says show last import. This will show the last group of data that you imported. That may be something that will further help you understand what the heck's going on here. So that's my advice for contacts. And I've had to wrestle with this in the past. And I found this sidebar priceless to help me figure out where things were coming from and how to clean things up.
Yeah.
Similar with calendar, you want to be sure, and it's in a similar place here. You're going to want to say show calendar list, and that's also in the view menu. Then on the left, it's going to, and like in my case, I have pretty much the same thing. I have iCloud, Facebook, and other. And everything's color-coded for the most part. If it's not, you want to make sure to color-code it so things are unique, so you know where what source they came from.
Just makes it easier, yeah.
Huh. Yeah, but it can get squirrely. The thing is, I do like mention of backing the data up, or at least importing. Well, to me, it implies that if you did an import, at some point you did an export.
Right. That's true. Yeah.
And that's something you probably should do on occasion it gets saved, as far as I know, if you do a time machine or any full backup. There's a data file kicking around somewhere, but if you want to explicitly save either your calendar or your contact data, you can do.
Uh-oh. Did I lose you, John?
I don't think so.
Oh, I heard a weird little audio artifact. Okay. Yeah, it's all good. Okay. No problem. Yeah. Yeah. I like I said, my gut says you have an iCloud problem and you're going to need to start. Part of the process is going to be flushing iCloud of its data and hopefully pushing from your Mac back up to iCloud and getting that syncing. Well, it's just.
iCloud is the thing we just love to shake our fist at.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there you go. Right. Yeah. All right. Let's, you know what? We've got a little bit of time left here. I want to answer Larry's question. We've actually had this one kicking around for a little while, but it's fun. So here we go. I say, here we go. And then of course I don't have Larry's question queued up and I don't even know that. Oh, I do have it. Here it is. Let's go.
Hi guys, this is Larry. I'm calling from the beautiful state of Michigan and the city of West Bloomfield. I have a quick VPN question for you. I obviously use it when I'm away from home at Starbucks, and I seem to always be at Starbucks, but I've got one of those unlimited VPN packages, and I'm curious if it makes sense to use it at home, if I'm susceptible to anything at home. I live in a condo complex, and there must be 6 or 8 or 10 signals that I can see, of course. They're all locked, just like mine is at home. But I'm just curious if I'm susceptible to anything at home that I would be at a Starbucks. That's my only question. Great show. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you bet, Larry. In a general sense, my answer is no. You don't need a VPN when you're at home. You need a VPN when you're somewhere else where it's a network that you don't manage, right? So the rule of thumb is, are there people are there devices on the same network as you that you don't either trust or manage? And if so, then yeah, you should be using a VPN. Now, which means at home, presumably you either manage or trust all the devices, including your router, and therefore you don't need a VPN. That's my general advice. Now,
I'm ready to shake my fist at you, but I think I know where you're going.
Yeah, understandably so, right? If you don't trust your internet provider, then you might want to use a VPN because you're going to get a tunnel out from there and all of that. In a general sense, I tend to trust my internet provider. I use Comcast, so. They're not going to be sniffing through people's data. If they were, it would be a widespread problem and they would go south. So, no, I don't use a VPN at home. And one of the problems, if I do log into a VPN, is that I lose easy access to whatever other devices are on my local network, right? So if I want to control my disk station or, you know, my Apple TV or any of that stuff, a lot of it just goes away if I'm connected to a VPN while I'm at home. So no, I don't think you need it, but John, I want to hear what you have to say here.
So from the point, if you're talking a privacy issue, because one of the functions of a VPN,
yep.
Although it's not a requirement, but it almost always happens, is that it's going to scramble or encrypt the data between you and whatever.
Sure.
So that I agree, it's redundant if you have a secure, if you're using, you know, a encrypted or secure connection to a Wi-Fi base station. The only case I would say where you may want to use a VPN, Dave, is if you want to mask your origin.
Oh.
Like, say you're doing something, trying to think how to word this properly.
Well, say you're in.
Let's say you have a need to change where you appear to be coming from.
Right. Which, if you're using like Netflix, and you want to, if you're traveling, yes. or even if you're not traveling, we have some overseas listeners, many, in fact, I think that choose to use a U.S. based Netflix account, and so, you know, you use a VPN and off you go.
Right. Like, I've used, And, you know, we love these guys, and I believe they sponsored us in the past. Tuttle Bear is one product that will do this, where you can say, hey, I'm in the UK. Hey, I'm in this country. I'm in that country. You may also need that functionality if, say, you're connecting to a service that will restrict what you can do based on your IP, and I think I'll leave it at that.
Well, that's like, Netflix, right? I mean...
Okay, there's some other services that also say, okay, I've seen you do, you know, something, and I'm not going to let you do it again because you're
vote early, usually, vote often.
Well, yes, but no, like, it's for true. Example, some services that let you download files, may restrict how much you can do if
got it. Okay.
Depending on the situation, I think that's as far as I'll go.
Okay.
with that one, but they're like, nope, you've already downloaded your allotment, and because I see you're coming from the same place, I'm not going to let you do it again.
Sure. Yeah.
But if you use a VPN, now I'm not. You know, this is not good or evil. It's just technology.
A tool. That's right. Yep.
The reason you may be using it can be good or evil.
Correct. Yeah. No. That's right. Yeah. So yeah. And your examples are all very, very valid. And I agree that they are reasons to use a VPN at home, and are reasons that I have used a VPN at home. But in a general sense, from a security standpoint, no, is my general answer.
Yes.
Yeah. And although, you know, Alex in the chat room says, look, you know, if you're a whistleblower, sometimes a journalist, you know, or as Furby's points out, if you think the FBI has reason to have put a tap on your, you know, Comcast connection, well, then by all means, perhaps you might want to be using a VPN. But otherwise, you know, no, you don't need one as a general practice at home. I do know of people that have VPN client software installed and active on their routers so that they can take their entire home network is tunneled over a VPN for a variety of reasons. And that can be an interesting setup. So it's, you know, that's just how it works. I don't know. It's fun. So that's why I wanted to answer the question. But John, that does mean that we're at the end.
Outstanding.
Yeah, I think so. Fun show. Hey, I want to thank I want to thank all of our premium listeners. We had quite a few of you in this show. You can find out about that at mattkeekab.com/premium. But going through the questions that we did answer, Chris, Matthew, Michael, Chuck, and then Larry to wrap up the show, all premium listeners that sent in questions this week. Thank you so much for supporting us directly. I really, really appreciate it. John and I both do. And we do answer everyone's questions that comes in, or at least that's our goal. But you premium folks that can send mail to premium@mattkeekab.com, you get first dibs on our time, understandably so. How else can they find us, John?
Feedback@mattkeekab.com.
No. You can't be serious. Feedback@mattkeekab.com?
I'm pretty sure. I'm almost 100% positive I said feedback@mattkeekab.com.
It's true. That's where you can email us. 224-888-GEEK is where you can call us. And John Geek is?
4335.
And you can find our awesome Facebook group. Not only will you find us there, but you'll find all of your, or a good sampling of your listening brethren there. So check that out at mattgeekgab.com/Facebook is the easiest way to get there. But you can go on Facebook and search for the Matt Geek Gab group. It's right there. It's great stuff. Really, really appreciative of everybody I'm appreciative of everybody that does anything to do with the show, but I was going to say appreciative of everybody that participates in our Facebook group. It's a blast. So thank you. I want to also thank the folks at CacheFly, CacheFly.com, for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. And I want to thank our sponsors, as we mentioned in the show, Power Photos from Fat Cat Software at fatcatsoftware.com/MGG. SeatGeek, where code MGG saves you $20. FreshBooks, where if you visit freshbooks.com/MGG, you'll get 30 days for free of FreshBooks. Additionally, in the podcast marketplace, Gazelle at gazelle.com. Smile at smilesoftware.com. Squarespace at squarespace.com/MGG. Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com. Barebones Software at barebones.com. And you, thank you so much for everything you do for us. It rocks. John, I have three pieces of advice for you and everyone. Or maybe they're not three pieces. It's three separate words, so I guess those are pieces. But they constitute a general concept that I think is important, especially as we have this week where there's an important holiday tomorrow here in the U.S. and then just the rest of the week where we're gonna do whatever we do to get everything done. And that advice is, folks, you're going to want to listen to this because this is special. Don't get caught.
Made up.